From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Is Congress getting a second impeachment in the works for President Trump? And in one of the busiest political weeks we've seen in a while, California's proposed budget just came down. We will break it down. Plus,
I used to say, hey, if you want to get to heaven, you got to go through Dodger Stadium.
Dodgers manager Tommy Lasorda passes away. Hall of Fame broadcaster Jaime Jarrín will share his memories. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. It's been quite the year in politics, and 2021 is only 8 days old. The storming of the nation's capital, White House resignations, calls for Donald Trump to resign, a movement to impeach him, and before all that, news from Georgia that the Democrats won both Senate seats, flipping the balance of power in that chamber for the next 6 years. Oh, and another thing, Governor Newsom released the California state budget. So let's get into all of that with State of Affairs, our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. And joining us is Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook, and Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Carla, Rafe, I still have not stopped thinking about what happened Wednesday at the Capitol. So let's start there. Rafe, with 2 days distance from it, what are you thinking about pro-Trump insurrection?
Oh, I think we're not going to be distanced from this for a long time. This was an amazing moment in American history. The White House inspired an attack on the legislative branch of government while the next three people in the line of succession were in that building. Could have led to assassinations. It led to five deaths already. And the most astounding thing is that the Capitol was left unguarded, or lightly guarded, despite numerous warnings. And it's going to take us a while to find out whether that was incompetence or something far worse.
Carla, what about you?
Well, I agree with Rafe. I mean, for the first time in American history, we saw no peaceful transfer of power in the wake of a presidential election. For the first time since 9/11, we saw the U.S. Capitol attacked and breached, and the Confederate flag paraded through the halls of Congress for the first time since the 1800s. I mean, it was a horrifying day. But I think we saw the news media take off the gloves and describe what we saw not as protesters, but as a siege, an attempted coup. And they were, as Rafe said, not just egged on by Trump, but in some cases by members of his party here in California. I think the question is now, what happens as Joe Biden and Kamala Harris assume power? Is there going to be other incidents? Is this the beginning or the end of the nightmare?
And one more thing on this, this is for both of you, Rafe and Carla. What word best describes what you were feeling when you were seeing it? Sadness, anger? I mean, what word was it for you? Rafe, go ahead.
Anger, shock, but not surprise. I felt a little bit the way Michael Corleone must have felt when he went upstairs and discovered that the police protection for Vito Corleone, his father, had been taken away, and therefore no protection was going to be provided. I mean, the leaving it unprotected was actually more shocking to me than the attack on the Capitol, because there has to be some message in that that is just of staggering historical importance.
Carla, what about you?
And I think for me, it was shades of 9/11. It felt the same way, horrifying. I mean, at one point, I did burst into tears while I was watching it on TV. It was such a moment. And I think for a lot of people, it brought back that same horror of 9/11. I'm not sure it's gone away, eh?
Now, later that night on Wednesday, Congress was able to come out from where they had been sheltering in place to resume the work of certifying the electoral votes. But even before all that, 147 Republicans still voted to overturn the election results. Seven of them from California, and they are Doug LaMalfa, Jay Obernolte, Ken Calvert, Daryl Issa, Kevin McCarthy, Devin Nunes, Mike Garcia. Now, Carla, Devin Nunes was actually awarded the Medal of Freedom by Donald Trump earlier this week, so we know that he is definitely in the president's favor. But remind us of the ties that some of those other congressmen have with Trump.
I mean, let's remember, some of these elector rejecting Trumps are very much established Trump loyalists in very deeply red districts where their voters share the admiration for Trump. And Kevin McCarthy has basically staked his political trajectory to Trump.
Trump called him My Kevin. I remember My Kevin.
That's right. Yeah. It's one of the reasons he leads the caucus today. And Devin Nunes, remember, you said was rewarded with the Presidential Medal, but he has been there for Trump from the beginning. And, you know, Garcia, I think, of Santa Clarita, it's interesting, barely won his election. That's 339 votes in a very purple district. Obernolte, as you mentioned, this is somebody who was seen as a mainly mainstream fiscal conservative in Sacramento. And so it's been interesting to watch how these California Republicans lined up with Trump in the last minute, and how and we've got to look at where their fortunes are going to lie from here on out. But no question about it, President Trump fired them up and California Republicans were there for him. As this went on.
Rafe, can you give us some insight here into what these Republicans were weighing as they took this stand? I mean, what do you think they see as the risks and rewards of sticking with the narrative that the election was somehow fraudulent?
I'm not sure they're thinking clearly. I don't know how they're thinking, but there's a sense in the Republican Party that wherever Trump goes, no matter how far he goes, you have to go with him. And that's not the same as thinking it through. When you're in a competitive district and won by 335 votes, you tend to stay toward the middle if you possibly can, as Young Kim did in Orange County. This, I think, is a catastrophe for California Republicans in a lot of ways. One is it overwhelmingly ties them to violence in Washington, D.C., and to kind of a white supremacist attack. I think it also hurts them a lot in their rising hopes of recalling Governor Gavin Newsom. Because by going down this road, the congressional delegation identifies the party with horrifying things. And don't forget, more information is going to come out before this is done. And they're going to be stuck with this. This is going to be around their neck for the rest of their careers.
You know, the Cook Partisan Voting Index, it measured how strongly a district swings red or blue. Now, on that list, Republican Congressman Kevin McCarthy's district has the highest score so far, with most of the rest comfortably in the red, except for Republican Mike Garcia in Santa Clarita. And you guys mentioned how purple that district is up there. Rafe, I suppose there's some logic to why all of the rest are still riding with Trump, because we mentioned, you know, their district reflects it. But is Garcia playing with fire?
You know, again, it's just hard to describe what it must be like to be a Republican politician during the Trump era, because, again, you have to go wherever he goes. It doesn't matter whether where he goes is a good place or a good place for you or a bad place for you. And people go down the rabbit hole. Now, if the Republican Party succeeds in whatever it is they're trying to do with some of these attacks on the election and other things, which I think won't be successful, I guess you could say it's a safe place to be because the Republican base still adores Donald Trump. But in the rest of the world where we live, the election was carried out, the election was successful, and actually we are having a peaceful transition of power. It's just being overwhelmed by this catastrophic event, but it has not been stopped. And in that world, it's hard to argue that they're not taking an immense risk in their future politics.
All right. Now, the question is what happens next? And today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi sent a letter to members of the House of Representatives, and she included this. Nearly 50 years ago, after years of enabling their rogue president, Republicans in Congress finally told President Nixon that it was time to go. Today, following the president's dangerous and seditious acts, Republicans in Congress need to follow that example and call on Trump to depart his office immediately. If the president does not leave office immediately and willingly, the Congress will proceed with our action. Okay, Carla. So she appears to be saying to the GOP, get him to resign or step down, or he's going to get impeached again. So what's the next move?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Nancy Pelosi is one who knows how to count votes. And she has said that her phone is exploding with impeach, impeach, impeach. And she has now seen numerous California Democrats, including Ted Lieu, including the incoming Senator Alex Padilla, Dianne Feinstein, all stand behind this. The feeling is that Trump has got to have, there has to be some repercussions for Trump's actions and his direct role in this, and that the California Democrats have got to act on this. Remember that Pelosi was a little bit reluctant in the first attempt on impeachment. She did not want to go lightly into it. But this time around, they feel the second impeachment, the first president in history to be impeached twice, that is probably a fitting punishment for him at this point. Interestingly enough, we just asked Governor Gavin Newsom if he was standing behind the impeachment drive. He sidestepped the question.
Oh, wow.
and said that he was not going to answer it, that he was more focused today on the California budget. But that's getting him a lot of criticism on the internet as we speak.
Wow, it would have been the easiest thing in the world, right, to say yes.
Yes, absolutely. It's a mystery why he didn't go there when three Republican governors and Andrew Cuomo today have also signed on to that.
Yeah, he says yes. No one gives it a second thought. But now it's a thing. Wow. Now, yesterday I spoke with a California Representative Mark DeCano, and this was his take on why Congress should impeach Trump.
This president is toxic to our democratic institutions. He is toxic to our democracy. He deserves and warrants being removed immediately. And we need to begin those proceedings as quickly as possible. And here's the thing. I don't really care that we don't have enough time. We only have 2 weeks left. If we have a shot at barring this man from ever holding federal office ever again in our country, that is a worthy goal in and of itself.
Now, Rafe, if these articles come down on Monday, as we're hearing they might, that would leave 9 days before President Trump's term is over. They would still need to get the Senate to go along with a conviction if there is an impeachment, but the two new Georgia senators are still not sworn in. So is it worth it, or do they even have the time to do this?
I'm not sure it matters. I think that what the Democrats have learned from the first impeachment is you have to first make the Republicans take a stand and explain why. So it's not only about Democrats being concerned about the president's behavior. The other thing is people will understand this. And who on earth knows where the Ukraine is located, let alone why that was an impeachable offense. Now this is clearly going to be there. I think there's a number of Republicans who might vote to convict who did not vote the first time. I doubt that there's 16, but there's a few people who may decide that this is worthy of a conviction vote. It certainly, though, puts the president on his heels for the last 2 weeks, and she's been working, Nancy Pelosi, to discourage efforts for him to do things out of line. She has publicized that she called the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss how to prevent what she called an unstable president from misusing his power over nuclear weapons. She wanted to make sure everybody knew she was having that conversation. So a lot of this are brushback pitches to say, do not try anything in the next 2 weeks. And impeachment, I think, is part of that.
And one thing to keep in mind, the House could include a provision to disqualify Donald Trump from holding a political office. So if they were to get the conviction in the Senate, then that would be some meat on that bone. But as I said, they would have to get the Senate to go along with that. Now, yesterday I spoke with another politician, California Assemblymember Chad Mays, who was a lifelong Republican until 2019. That's when he switched to being an independent. And he cited the violent rhetoric and ideology of the GOP under Trump. So let's listen to that.
The moment for me began when I went to run for re-election in 2018, and I polled my district, and I asked a question in that poll about how I stood up at the Republican Party against white nationalists. And amongst Democrats, it was more likely. Amongst independents, it was more likely that they would vote for me. But what shocked me was amongst Republicans, it actually went negative, that people were less likely to support me.
Mays says that in California, the GOP is on life support, but that it still has a pulse. Carla, do you agree?
It does have a pulse, but it's very weak at this point. I mean, the GOP in California has always been sort of a multi-headed hydra, a mix of social conservatives, religious conservatives, and then you've got moderates like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Remember, he back in 2008 warned that the party was failing at the box office. I mean, right now, here's the problem. Some of the very same people we saw take the Capitol this week have been aligned with some of these fringe efforts here in California. And I have to say, Ashley Babbitt, the San Diego woman who died while trying to breach the Capitol, was part of sort of this QAnon effort. She was a supporter of the recall of Governor Newsom. As Rafe said, that's a movement that now has to worry about separating itself from some of these more fringe elements. That's where the comeback is going to be. The GOP had some comeback in 2020 with Garcia, with Michelle Steele, Young Kim. And remember, Kevin Falconer, mayor of San Diego, former, is trying to challenge Governor Newsom, as is John Cox, in the next gubernatorial election. All that will depend on how the voting public sees the party and its role in what happened this week.
Rafe, what possible roads do you see for the GOP to go to once Trump is no longer president?
I can't figure it out, honestly. I believe they are going to still be having to decide what to do, whether to stick with him or not. And I don't know how you don't stick with him, because he takes revenge on everybody who doesn't stick with him. And I think he'll still be the leading force in the Republican Party. I still think if he wants to be the nominee in 2024 for president, it'll be his for the asking. But I think it's going to make it impossible for them to build on what Carla just said. They picked up 4 House seats, and they have Falconer. They have a recall that, you know, maybe might have some kind of a distant shot. These are like green shoots for the Republican Party comeback. And now, as often happens, Trump does as much damage, if not more, to his own party as he does to the Democrats. He's actually made the Democrats, a far more high turnout party and far more united. But his own party, I don't know what you do at this point.
Well, yeah, we're all more or less the same age. We grew up in a very different California where the Republic, I mean, it was a viable two-party state, wasn't it? And I guess a lot of people point to Pete Wilson with 187 as the reason why it isn't that way. I mean, is that gaining a lot more traction, you think, now, Carla? Or is that just something that people like to point to for blame?
Well, you know, talking to Alex Padilla this week, the next U.S. senator from California, he says that the reason he entered politics, he was an MIT engineering graduate. He entered politics because of 187. That has been a point for so many Latinos here in California. Remember, they're the fastest growing electorate. So absolutely, that is a group that has been lost largely to the Republican Party in California. And somehow trying to get them back, especially with the events that we've seen this week, may be a very difficult task.
Carla Mannucci, Rafe Sonnenschein, stay with us after a short break. We're going to get into Governor Newsom's proposed budget that came out today. That's coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with War Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Abe Martinez. Time now for a little bonus State of Affairs, our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. We're with Carla Mannucci, senior writer, Politico's California Playbook, and also Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Before we get to Governor Newsom's budget, I want to go back to a little bit to what we saw happen in Georgia. The balance of power in the Senate changed. Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff in Georgia. The projected winners, they still haven't been sworn in yet, but that is going to happen eventually. Senate now split 50-50 with Vice President-elect Kamala Harris presiding as a tie-breaking vote. Rafe, what does this mean for California that Mitch McConnell will no longer be Senate Majority Leader?
Well, it doesn't change everything, but it changes a whole lot. It means that the Senate the agenda will be under the control of the Democrats. It also means that you're already going to have a more sympathetic president who is going to help the governor and the legislature accomplish things in California rather than treating it as the enemy. Some things will pass, some things won't pass. Some things will have to be still subject to a filibuster. Sometimes you'll lose Joe Manchin of West Virginia. So it's by no means the blank check that people think Democrats are going to get, but you would certainly rather be where they are now than in the more likely case that they lose both seats. It's a rather miraculous victory, to tell you the truth.
And given that California has seemingly been in a four-year-long tussle with the federal government, I'm wondering, Carla, what changes do you think will happen for the state now that Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House, in addition to having a bunch of Californians serving in the Biden administration?
Well, you know, you heard Gavin Newsom say it today that in 12 days we have the Biden administration. He's expecting a lot more help from them on key issues like vaccines and other things. But it also means, you know, Californians may take a role controlling some of the key committees in the Senate. And look, California's newest senator, Alex Padilla, may have a greater chance of passing some important legislation. Remember also that the Georgia elections mean that there's a much bigger chance of Javier Becerra being confirmed as Biden's Health and Human Services Secretary. That was maybe in danger before. So for a lot of different reasons, with the Democrats controlling presidency, House, and the Senate, Gavin Newsom and the state legislature are breathing a sigh of relief today.
Yeah, I forgot about those confirmation hearings. That still has to happen. If they have time, I guess, they have a lot on their plate, I suppose. All right, so Gavin Newsom did release a proposed state budget. Carla, what are the biggest takeaways for you?
I mean, yeah, we just sat through about a two-hour presentation by the governor. And the good news is, look, California is expected to have a budget surplus. That is big news, particularly this year. He said he's projecting $15.6 billion in the next year. And that's the result of high earners in California. They contribute the lion's share of taxes. But that's a one-time windfall. Look, he's looking at rolling out a number of different proposals using some of that money in his $227 billion fiscal blueprint that came out today. For instance, among the highlights, $600 cash payments to the state's lowest wage workers. That's going to be distributed in March and February. Cash infusions to state programs that offer tax credits to business and apprenticeship. He wants to do $6.7 billion he's projecting in federal COVID relief and about $330 million for vaccines. I mean, this is a major issue that he's facing. When and how is he going to get those vaccines into California's arms? He's also talking about $2 billion on incentives to reopen schools and about $1 billion for wildfire risk. So this is an ambitious budget. California is in a much better shape than many states, but Newsom knows he's got to get a lot of stuff done. And the COVID issue is the big thing on his plate right now.
Yeah, the Golden State Stimulus. I kind of like the way it sounds. Cool name. Good, nice name for the stimulus that he's going to send. Yeah. Rafe, what about for you? What are the biggest things that jump out in the proposed budget?
Well, I think all the things that Carla said, I think the most dramatic thing are the stimulus checks, but the more powerful things is probably the aid to renters and to businesses and to open the schools, because while that's indirect in a way, it's going to provide major benefits. I think that'll help a lot. Look, the budget presentations are always prose, not poetry. But the poetry to come is, does the governor take advantage of the tremendous opportunity for leadership in the vaccine rollout, or does he get caught in the weeds of detail and not really, in a sense, the terrible problem of getting the vaccine out is also a perfect opportunity for leadership to show management skill, the ability to get something done. You don't have to have any new discoveries. You don't have to have anything miraculous. As he put it, you just have to get the vaccine into the arms. Now, that's something executives can do, and they can do it in a way that's highly visible to people. If he pulls that off, I think the recall is going to not be nearly as worrisome as it appears to be right now.
And Carla, yeah, you know, this having a surplus, considering everything this state and all of its residents have gone through in this year, well, not this year, in last year, 2020, it is amazing to hear that word surplus.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you're looking at major tech, you know, stars like Elon Musk and Larry Ellison of Oracle saying that they're leaving the state. That's why this is a one-time deal. He noted that. But it does point out, as something that Newsom has talked about all along, that California is America's next coming attraction. California is a place that has been the center of the innovation economy, and that is what is saving California right now in a lot of ways.
We're talking to Carla Marinucci, senior writer, Politico's California Playbook, also Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Now, those stimulus payments, they would get sent out in February and March. But I have to note that the deadline to get the required amount of signatures for the Gavin Newsom recall is March 17th. Call me cynical, but how does the timing of all of this affect that cloud over Newsom's head, Carla?
I mean, coincidence? I don't know about that. And I think it's interesting, too, that he noted that a lot of the vaccines are supposed to be out there in, by early spring. The fact is that, yes, the proponents of this recall said they have already collected 1 million signatures. They have about $1 million in the bank, it sounds like. And they are very, very hopeful of getting this done. But as Rafe said, some of the effects of this week may be too much for them. There's no question about it that Newsom's team is very much aware of this recall. And with California's crazy politics, anything can happen. And he knows that, and he's got to get the stuff done this week when it comes to vaccines and the budget rollout. All of this is hanging over his head as this recall looms.
Rafe, I'm in showbiz, so I know all about timing. It's all about timing. That's at least what I've heard. When it comes to this, I mean, could this be something that could be a boost to Gavin Newsom, especially when it comes to maybe people approving of him? I mean, you send $600 to someone. I mean, I don't know if they care where it comes from as long as they get it.
Well, I think what's really helpful is what he said at the end. He reminded you that he's taking several items out and say, do these right now. Don't wait for the completion of the whole budget. And that's a really smart move. Forgetting March 17th, which is arbitrary, they're probably going to get enough signatures. I mean, I don't think that's going to be discouraged by any of this. But showing impact on the schools, on stimulus, on rent, and on business, and doing it now. Look, it doesn't matter if you don't do it now. You have to do it now. This is the time. The latest jobs report in the country is pretty terrible. It's really got to happen. On the other hand, people have a short memory. And that's why I go back to, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but the vaccine rollout is something that will really stick in people's minds if it's done well. Really be clear, communicated well, not getting in the weeds, moving things, moving people out who aren't getting it done, bringing in the right people, all of that stuff. That's going to stay in people's minds for quite a while.
But everything you just mentioned, Rafe, that's what's been happening. It has not gone well. Even Gavin Newsom has said it has not gone well enough. I mean, so when we think about speeding up the distribution of the vaccines in the state, I mean, what do you see as the government's role in this poor rollout by their own admission of the distribution of it?
Well, in fairness, like everything else with the epidemic, the national government abdicated completely and said, you all figure it out in the state. So let's not let them off the hook on this. And it's playing out that way. Now, you can only get away with that for so long. And I think the time on that has pretty much run out. Everybody gets a mulligan in every state for being abandoned by the federal government on the vaccine rollout where there was no plan. So you start from right now. And you start from right now and you begin to develop a totally clear and transparent plan. And you start day by day, roll up your sleeves and carry it out. It'll be fine.
Carla, what do you think on this? Because, you know, everyone got so excited. I remember I was one of them when I knew that this was on the way, that the end was near. I mean, you almost felt and saw the light at the end of this very dark tunnel that we've all been in. But now when we see timetables and timeframes and things look like they're even pushed back even further into 2021, maybe even 2022, I mean, I can't help but feel like a lot of people feel it's like a defeated kind of feeling.
You know, exactly, A, that is the question I asked Gavin Newsom today. When can you promise Californians that they're going to get this vaccine? How will they know they can get it? And at this point, we still really don't have an answer. He said that neither Dr. Fauci nor any of the medical experts can really tell us. Yes, he gives us examples that there are committees looking at it and this three-tiered system. The bottom line is, if he can't answer people's questions about where to get it and how to get it, and soon, before next summer, he's got to worry about it. He's got to worry about his political future.
In a book that GOP State Assemblyman Kevin Kiley wrote, it's titled Recall Newsom. He writes, California's response to COVID-19 has been the worst in America, with incomparable economic destruction, loss of life, and violations of democratic norms. Now, Kiley clearly has an agenda, but then we find out that according to the California Department of Public Health, 1.5 million doses of the vaccine are stuck in transit all over the state. And that number is up from the previous backlog of 900,000. And even Newsom, we mentioned, admitted that the rollout has been too slow. Rafe, I mean, there's a State of the State address coming soon. How critical is the rest of January for Newsom and a little bit into February?
Well, I never think anything's a particularly critical time.
I know, it's a very dramatic word. I'm even ashamed of using it.
But I mean, if this is on the ballot, it'll be on the ballot after the signatures are gathered. They'll have a date set. He's really got to have a lot to show by then. But my point is, you don't have to do it all at once. There's no single speech. There's no single moment. But at a certain point, there's no reason not to get it done. I think we're not quite at that point yet because it's just been a mess so far. On January 20th, there will be some help from the federal government for the first time on the vaccine distribution. That's going to help. But I think this is a matter, and I guess what I'm arguing is against the general rule of politics of, you know, whatever's the biggest thing going on that day. This has to be an everyday blue-collar approach, beginning to end, and then I think it'll get done in plenty of time for him to have a good political outcome.
Carla, March 17th is the date when those signatures have to be ready and collected. Ideally, for Gavin Newsom's sake, where would he or things have to be at that point for him not to feel any pressure from this recall effort?
He has three jobs he has to do. He has to get the schools open in California. That is huge to millions of parents in this state. He has to get the economy back on track, and he has to get those vaccines into the arms of people. Those are the three things he's going to be judged on when March 17th comes around. And so that's his to-do list. It's a very big one, and he knows it.
And actually, a little bit of breaking news. According to CNN, the articles of impeachment, this is obtained by CNN, reported by CNN, they include one article of impeachment for incitement of insurrection. Incitement of insurrection, this is according to CNN. Rafa, what do you think? Incitement of insurrection, how do you think that plays?
I think it's very important that it's in there, especially because the Department of Justice said this morning that they are not going to explore criminal charges against those who incited the event. So it's even more important that it be in these articles. I think it's all going to be very dramatic. I'll tell you what I'm watching, though, right now is the law enforcement response, because if it is not an overwhelming response and they're starting to arrest people around the country, this is going to spread to state legislatures throughout the country. It already happened before in Michigan with threats against the life of the governor and breaking into the Capitol. This is going to spread like wildfire unless there are major consequences. And they're finally finding people, charging people, but it has to go very far and very deep to keep this from metastasizing.
Carla, what do you think about incitement of insurrection as one article of impeachment?
As Rafe said, I think it's appropriate, and I think this is what many people are watching to see what the response is going to be. Remember that President Trump called for 10-year minimum sentence for anyone defacing public property or federal property. We'll see if those standards are applied to his own followers, and he's going to have to answer for it as well. And I think that is the overwhelming sentiment among the House right now, and we'll see how that plays out as well.
And really quick, I got just a few seconds left. What will you two be keeping an eye out on for next week? Rafe, really quick.
I'm looking at the consequences of this event and to understand what was really behind it and how the Capitol was left unguarded. That story is yet to be told. I think it's going to be a devastating story when we finally know everything there is to know.
Carla, 10 seconds.
Whether the man who's been barred from Facebook and Snapchat is going to be accessing the nuclear codes in the next 12 days. That's the bottom line here.
Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Rafe, Carla, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, coming up, our memories of Tommy Lasorda, passed away last night, a heart attack, age of 93. We'll have a Hall of Fame broadcaster, Jaime Jarrín, former Major League manager Kevin Kennedy, relay some of their thoughts. It's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. one of the few songs I know by heart, word for word. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez.
I used to say, hey, if you want to get to heaven, you got to go through Dodger Stadium.
That was Dodger manager and Baseball Hall of Famer Tommy Lasorda. He passed away of a heart attack yesterday at the age of 93. Tommy was born in Norristown, Pennsylvania in 1927 and joined the Dodgers organization in 1948 as a left-handed pitcher. Now, Lasorda was a really good minor league pitcher with a curveball that Clayton Kershaw would be proud of, but he never had success in the big leagues. He was up for a cup of coffee with the Brooklyn Dodgers before they sent him back down to make room for another lefty. That guy was Sandy Koufax. So yeah, that was the correct call by the Brooklyn Dodgers back then. Tommy later became a Dodgers scout and successful Dodgers minor league manager, and that led him to taking over at the top of the organization in 1976. He oversaw the Dodgers for 20 years as manager, and in that time, the team won two World Series, the first in 1981 over the Yankees. But his crowning achievement happened in 1988, when the underdog Dodgers beat the favored New York Mets in the National League Championship Series, then went on to face the even more heavily favored Oakland A's in the World Series. And the signature moment was his decision to bring in injured Kirk Gibson to the plate in the ninth inning of Game 1. Vin Scully with the call.
But the game right now is at the plate. High fly ball into right field. She is gone! In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
Still get chills. I mean, it was so improbable, so impossible, because even after that incredible moment, I remember sitting in front of the TV, 17 years old, I still didn't believe that they could beat the mighty Oakland A's. But they did, and Tommy knew it the whole time. Here he is celebrating after the Dodgers Game 5 win in 1988. In all, Tommy Lasorda spent 71 years with the Dodgers. He was arguably the team and baseball's most willing and passionate ambassador. And here to tell us more about the life and legacy of Tommy Lasorda is fellow Hall of Famer and Dodgers broadcaster Jaime Jarrín. Jaime, welcome back.
Hello, A. How are you?
Good.
Nice to hear from you.
And nice to hear from you, too. Also with us is former Boston Red Sox and Texas Rangers manager Kevin Kennedy, who played and managed in the Dodgers organization. Kevin, welcome to you as well.
Hey, thank you very much. Nice to hear from you.
Now, you know, I know Tommy was 93, and I know he had been recently hospitalized, but I think when it finally happens, it's a gut punch that I don't think anybody is truly prepared for. Jaime, let's start with you. When you heard the news, what were you thinking? What were you feeling?
Well, this is a very sad day, even though, as you say, we knew that the final day was coming very, very closely. It shook me up this morning when Joe from the Dodgers called me to let me know that Tommy has passed away. I have so much, so great memories about Tom that's impossible to put it on right now. I feel shocked and I feel sad, because I was very fortunate to be, for over 60 years, very near Tommy Lasorda. I remember the first time I met him when we were doing a game from the Coliseum, and he came down to Los Angeles with Charlie Huff and Dan Sutton to introduce them to the Dodgers. They had just been signed by the Dodgers. That was the first time that I met Tom. Then we became very, very close friends, and he gave me the opportunity to be near him, baseball for so many years, and appreciate that. He was very special with me. I will never forget him, because the way that he was such a great person, you know, in Los Angeles. I think the most loved people in Los Angeles, no question about it.
Kevin, what about you when you first heard the news?
Well, I knew that when he was in the hospital for 6 weeks that it probably wasn't good, but I got a call from Rick Monday a couple of days ago and said that he said that Tommy got home, but that his kidneys were failing. That's what Rick said. And then I got a call this morning, first thing, from Rick as well. We've stayed very close since we started working together the last 7-8 years. And he told me the sad news, and I didn't expect it because I thought that when he went home that maybe he had plenty of time, or a couple of months, something like that, that he would be home with Joe. As Jaime mentioned, Joe Lasorda has been with him from day one, wonderful lady. And it from that standpoint, it really shocked me. I just didn't expect it from day one. We know that when you're 93 years old, and he's been in ill health off and on with going with the heart attack in 96, et cetera. But you're still shocked because Tommy is one of those guys that's the most positive person I've ever met in my life. That was probably, as you know, his legacy. You've been around him a lot. And, there's not one thing that he doesn't believe he could do. There's not one game he doesn't believe he could win. Not one team, one series, he doesn't believe his teams are going to win. So if there was one phrase or one thing I would think that stands out about Tommy among any other baseball person I've ever been around, is about motivation and about how positive he was, even if he was the underdog, as you mentioned, with the World Series in 88.
Yeah.
And many other games as well. But I was surprised. I was shocked.
Now we're going to get into memories of Tommy, his legacy in the game, his legacy in Los Angeles. Jaime and Kevin, please stick around. We're going to come back in just a second. We're talking to Jaime Jarrín, fellow Hall of Famer, Dodgers broadcaster, and Kevin Kennedy, former Red Sox and Rangers manager. More memories of Tommy Lasorda coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
We are the world champs of baseball. And I'll tell you something, it is a great, great ball club. They never quit believing in themselves. They have to be an influence on everybody in the world because it shows you what someone can do when they really want something bad enough. Nobody believed that this team could finish first in the division. Nobody believed that we could beat the Mets. Nobody believed that we can beat the Athletics who won 104 games. We did it.
That's Dodger manager Tommy Lasorda. Welcome back to Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Tommy Lasorda passed away yesterday at the age of 93. We're talking to fellow Hall of Famer and Dodgers broadcaster Jaime Jarrín and also former Red Sox and Rangers manager Kevin Kennedy. Kevin played and managed in the Dodgers organization. Guys, one of the things when it comes to Tommy that I think everyone agrees with, I mean, people feel all kinds of things for Tommy, but him being an ambassador for the Dodgers brand and also for the game of baseball. Jaime, I don't know if there is anyone that loves the sport and loves that franchise more than Tommy Lasorda, or at least showed it as he did.
Yes, the legacy that Tommy Lasorda leaves is unparalleled. He was the best ambassador that baseball have ever had. He loved visiting other countries, especially Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. And he was so instrumental in the development of young Latino ball players trying to reach the major leagues. He worked hours and hours and hours, extra hours, with Raul Mondesi, with Pedro and Ramon Martinez, with Henry Rodriguez, Alex Cora, Cesar Esturiz, luego Mai Piazza, Juan Say, Eric Carlos. It was unbelievable to see Tam Lasorda working with those kids. I remember vividly among the heat and the humidity of Vero Beach, he will pitch for 1 hour or 2 hours to Raul Mondesi because he wanted him to hit the curveball. And so the legacy that he leaves is unparalleled, is unbelievable, because he loved Los Angeles. He represented baseball like nobody else. With his personality, he was able to reach to so many people.
And you mentioned, his influence in Latin America. Tommy also worked very hard at being able to communicate with Latin American ball players. Let's get an example of Tommy's Spanish.
Gracias, Ruben. Es mi honor para hablar contigo porque yo posible es la única persona en este estadio que recuerda a ti cuando tú eres flaco, es pobre. Ahora tú eres más gordo.
That's Tommy talking to Ruben Amaro. Yeah, and I mean he that's pretty good Spanish. That's all right.
Oh, yeah, it is very colorful. Very colorful in Spanish, I will say. But he got the message across.
Yeah.
And he was a great teacher, a great instructor, and he loved baseball above all.
Kevin, you trained basically under Tommy. Tommy is the manager of the Dodgers. Yeah. You were a minor league manager. What was Tommy Lasorda's managerial style like?
I think it was more of, the positive attitude more than the teaching part, except for the pitching, like Jaime said. Because I remember my guys. I had Eric Karros in AAA, and I had, Raul Mondesi came to me in AAA. Pedro came to me in AAA.
Pedro Martinez, yeah.
Yeah, 36 innings pitch. He came to me, and I was involved in trading for him in Montreal. People don't like that in L.A., I know, but we loved it in Montreal. But anyway, and he would get some guys that were prospects, and he said, Kevin, I'm going to get your guys, some of your guys. I'm going to throw to Karros and handful of guys. And he would challenge these AAA guys and sometimes AA guys to hit his curveball. I'll never forget that in spring training at Dodger Town. And sure enough, he'd be out there throwing to him for a good hour, like Jaime said. And I used to go out there and shag for him. A few of us would go out there and shag for him. And he loved doing that. And he would raise his hands if he could get one by Karros on a curveball or he popped it up or anything. I mean, that was Tommy. It was just his positive attitude as far as the managerial thing. But what I wanted to learn from him once I got to AAA, when we'd go to dinner, and in Dodger Town, as you know, everybody eats together. You could be sitting next to Sandy Koufax one day. You could be sitting next to, Ron Say another day, whatever. Well, Tommy's table was right near the entrance to where you go in line to get your food. And he would sit there with his coaching staff, which at the time was Joe Ferguson and Billy Russell and Mark Cressy. I remember those three specifically. And when Tommy started inviting me to his table in 1989, my first year in AAA, I started feeling like I kind of arrived, and I would just pick his brain on. I wanted to know really more about managing the media, handling the media, than anything else.
You know what, Kevin? On that note, let's hear Tommy managing the media. He's being asked about Dave Kingman, who hit three home runs against the Dodgers after one game.
Good.
What's my opinion of Kingman's performance? What the f*** do you think is my opinion of it? I think it was put that in. I don't opinion of his performance. He beat us with three home runs. What the f*** do you mean? What is my opinion of his performance? How could you ask me a question like
that? Jaime, you spent a lot of time with Tommy. How much of that was real? How much of that was performance for the sake of performing?
It was real. Lasorda,
yeah.
It was real, really. The thing with Tommy, outside of all players, if you're invited to join him at his table, that was really something very special.
Yeah.
At least that's what I felt.
Absolutely.
He was always surrounded by players, but if he invited you to his table and you were not wearing a uniform, you were very special. And he showed me the kindness and he showed me his love. He loved my wife. Oh, my goodness. Blanca was in love with Tommy Lasorda because Tommy, he had a great, great, great talent to memorize the names of every wife of every ball player, and not only the wife, the father and the mother. It was unbelievable. I love it, Tommy Lasorda.
We only got about 60 seconds left. Just want to get your thoughts on how Tommy should be remembered. Kevin, quickly, your thoughts.
As the greatest ambassador that our sport will ever have, nobody's going to surpass that. And the greatest love of one organization that anybody could ever imagine. He didn't want to go anywhere. When he got offered to go to Montreal for 3 years, he turned it down, and he stayed with the one-year contracts until finally he got a multi-year deal. Took a few years, but finally he got that. But that was out of loyalty to the Dodgers. So loyalty and the ambassadorship are the two things that stick out to me.
Jaime, what about you? About 30 seconds.
I will say that Tommy Lasorda is the brightest Dodger of all time, especially wearing a uniform as a player, as a coach, as a manager. He is the biggest personality that baseball produces in Los Angeles.
Jaime Jarrín, Kevin Kennedy, thank you very much for your memories.
My pleasure, eh? Good talk to you, Jaime.
Okay, great. David, are you there?
Missed any part of take two? It was a good one. Just head on over to wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also follow us on Twitter at take two. I'm there as well at amartinezla. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take two is back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.